Chapter 31. Staging Dorothy Kilgallen's death scene meant there was placement of the body away from its original location, arguably the bathroom, in the wrong bed, in the wrong bedroom, while Kilgallen still had on her makeup, false eyelashes, and hairpiece. However, the assailant, if it was not Richard, may not have known it was the wrong bed in the wrong bedroom. Adding to the mystery is the medical examiner's notation that Kilgallen, while wearing the strange nightclothes, wore nothing else. No account was provided as to whether a bra or panties was discovered, either in the bedroom or her nearby dressing room. If Richard was the culprit, perhaps he removed the undergarments when he undressed her and then redressed her before placing Kilgallen in bed, somehow forgetting to provide her with undergarments. If Richard was not involved in Kilgallen's death and slept through the entire deadly encounter, was Kilgallen undressed by the killer? If so, what happened to the chiffon dress she was wearing when she left the Regency Hotel bar? Regardless, to conclude that the assailant would have had the inclination to remove the dress, remove any undergarments, and replace them with the odd nightclothes seems unlikely, pointing toward Richard having done so. Logic fails when considering the true reasons for the death scene existing, as it did in the early morning hours of November 8, 1965. However, based on new evidence discovered in 2017 and 2018, a better indication of what happened to Kilgallen is possible. The focus thus shifts, as it must, to the mystery man who met her at the Regency Hotel during the early morning hours before she died. Pinpointing exactly who Kilgallen feared most when she died is subject to conjecture, but her death was no accident, according to several sources acquainted with her, or people who knew her. They include the following individuals. Bill Franklin, Johnny Ray's manager. Johnny didn't believe she died of natural causes. I ain't gonna tell you everything that I know about what Dorothy knows about the JFK assassination. But I don't believe that she laid down and went to sleep like that. It's dangerous to know what Dorothy knows. Upon learning of Kilgallen's death, Franklin said Ray was overwhelmed with grief. He started crying like a baby. Johnny Ray, to television host Joe Franklin. Beyond question, I believe Dorothy was murdered. I just couldn't prove it. Alan Eichler, Johnny Ray's subsequent manager. Johnny knew Dorothy was killed. He knew who the killer was and how it was done and who did it. But he couldn't prove it. He was convinced she was murdered. He said Dorothy had extensive assassination files, and she was certain she knew the truth about who killed JFK. Johnny believed that's why she was killed. Syndicated columnist Liz Smith. Dorothy did know too much. Her murder was very mysterious. Kilgallen's friend, Jean Bach. If enough people believed Dorothy had the scoop on what really happened in the JFK assassination, that would impel them into some sort of violent action. Kilgallen's friend, stand-up comedian Steve Rossi. They alleged that Kilgallen died from an overdose of barbiturates, but I know for a fact that she wasn't taking anything at the time. Once she started writing the book on the Kennedy assassination, I think somebody came in there and poisoned her. Pat Moore, the longtime waitress at P.J. Clark's. Everybody had this feeling Dorothy was murdered. Earl Ruby, Jack's brother. September 30th, 1995, audiotaped interview. Kilgallen's death was suspicious. In a 2017 interview with Kilgallen's daughter, Jill, she told New York Post reporter Sue Edelman, "I don't believe my mother was murdered. That is far-fetched. Lots of misinformation out there. People have said space aliens killed her, but anything is possible." Jill then added, "My brothers and I are kind of over it. My brothers are not interested in mother's case." However, new evidence garnered since Jill was interviewed reveals that, during the 1970s, she seemed certain that her mother had not died accidentally or committed suicide. The primary source evidence was provided to this author by Bob Schulenberg, a Los Angeles illustrator and former film production designer at Zoetrope Studios. His sketches later appeared on the New York Social Diary website. When contacted by this author in 2017, Schulenberg said, "I was living in New York at the time, and the dinner with Jill may have been at Mortimer's, a clubby Upper East Side restaurant. Although at this remove, it's difficult to say. It may have been at the time that Mark Lane gave a Kennedy assassination weekend presentation that I attended at NYU. Regarding the dinner, he said, it's possible that that's the reason the subject of the JFK assassination came up. And that's when Jill said, 'My mother was murdered.' This statement echoes that of Brenda DeJordan, who told this author that Jill, whom Brenda believed had a nervous breakdown after her mother died, told James, 'They murdered my mother.'" Schulenberg, who was noted had sketched Kilgallen with Johnny Ray during dinner at P.J. Clark's, told this author that Marianne Harrison, Jill's closest childhood friend, and Schulenberg's friend, David Columbia, were also at the dinner. To confirm Schulenberg's dinner conversation account, this author contacted Harrison at her home in July 2017. She had not read The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, and a promise was made to send her a copy. Harrison was cordial and most willing to talk about Jill and Dorothy Kilgallen. She told of her childhood friendship with Jill, revealing that we both went to Knox private school together at 13. Then later we had a business called Smith Colmar that sold high-end sweaters. "I attended Jill's wedding," Harrison added. "There was a big party her mom threw at the Regis Hotel. I knew Dorothy well and went to her home many times. Hung out in the black room, met Johnny Ray and Bobby Short, among others. One time, my date, later my husband, we went to El Morocco, a fancy restaurant, but we came in late. Dorothy got us a table. It was $20 for all the drinks you wanted." Asked to describe Dorothy Kilgallen at the time, Harrison said, "She was quite glamorous. Especially, I remember, when she covered the Profumo case in England. She was a good mother to Jill. Dorothy took Jill and me to the dentist. I just looked at her as the mother of my friend." Harrison said Jill never talked about her family. She was very guarded about all that. "I tried to talk to Jill about her mom, but Jill wouldn't go there. I never saw Dorothy drunk or drugged. Maybe sleeping pills. She did work long hours." Asked if she knew what Kilgallen was investigating when she died, Harrison said, "Yes, I knew she was working on the JFK assassination. I heard she was quieted. I thought maybe something happened to her, but Jill, if she thought that, she wouldn't talk about it." Harrison continued by saying, "When Dorothy died, there was speculation that Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy's murder were connected. I never believed that conspiracy." Regarding the NYC dinner with Bob Schulenberg and David Columbia, where Schulenberg said Jill said, "My mother was murdered," Harrison said, "I don't recall it, but it could have happened. Requested to contact Jill and see if she could help with information about this author's investigation." Harrison said, "I will call her, but she will shut down." On July 25th, after giving Harrison time to read The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, her husband had done so, not Harrison, this author telephoned her. Instead of a cooperative attitude like before, she immediately shouted, "I'm not going to talk to you, give you any information. I talked to Jill. She doesn't care about the book. They are an extremely private family. Never talk about Dorothy. The family is paranoid about privacy." When confronted with her having been of assistance before, to the extent that she said she had heard Kilgallen had been quieted, Harrison retorted, "I never said any of those things to you. It's all hearsay. The hairdressers, the butler, etc. And I wasn't good friends with Bob Schulenberg." With that, Harrison rudely hung up. Of all the statements made that Kilgallen's life was taken from her at such an early age, Jill's admission to two different people that her mother was killed and Harrison's statement that she heard Kilgallen was quieted may be the most potent. The forensic evidence that she had not one, not two, but three barbiturates in her bloodstream, the combination being deadly, solidifies the conclusion that she was murdered. If Richard Colmar was not responsible for Kilgallen's death, or Frank Sinatra had no one kill her under his orders, then the finger points at J. Edgar Hoover or Carlos Marcello. Each could have acted on his own, or in concert, if that is possible. Motive? Both men had to silence the nosy reporter. Hoover, threatened by potential allegations of a cover-up, and thus obstruction of justice, and Marcello, due to the loss of millions of dollars if his empire was crushed by indictment and possible imprisonment. Regarding this scenario, it is very unlikely either of the two powerful figures would have been directly involved with the actual murder, leading to them hiring or forcing an operative or operatives to do the dirty work. Hoover could have certainly reached within the Bureau or used shady figures known to the Bureau who could eliminate Kilgallen. As for Marcello, the possibilities are unlimited. He could have employed thugs either in New Orleans to poison her or reached into New York City, where his compatriot Frank Costello's contacts in the underworld would have handled the job. When choosing the most logical course of action for either man, confiscating Kilgallen's thick JFK investigation file must have been part of any murder plot. That FBI agents infiltrated Kilgallen's townhouse shortly after she died suggests Hoover orchestrating Kilgallen's death, unless it was a joint effort with Marcello. Also important to note is that James Clement does not acknowledge proof the agents were in fact FBI. Phony credentials may have been used to make him believe this was true. To date, no one has actually acknowledged reading the file, although reports surfaced that Kilgallen shared either the file or notes from her interview with Jack Ruby with Florence Pritchett, who became Florence Smith when she married Earl E.T. Smith, appointed in 1957 as ambassador to Cuba. Despite these claims, no credible evidence has surfaced that Kilgallen shared her evidence with Smith, nay Pritchett, the fashion editor at the Journal American who remained friends with JFK until he died. Why was Kilgallen's file so valuable? Exactly what it contained has been difficult to assess, but common sense dictates that it held early interview notes from sources in Dallas, specifically inside the Dallas Police Department, notes from the Ruby trial testimony, notes from her Jack Ruby interviews, notes regarding her suspicions about Melvin Belli's bogus defense of Ruby, notes regarding her trip to New Orleans, and perhaps, though unlikely, mention of those who may have threatened her. In a more general sense, one credible source appears to be Johnny Ray biographer Johnny Whiteside, based, as noted, on inside information when he collaborated on Ray's biography. Whiteside wrote, "The fruit of an 18-month investigatory workload, the file was described by contemporaries as a bulging sheaf of documents, notes, research, interview transcriptions, contacts, photographs, and clippings." She had personally guarded the material, kept it either by her side or under lock and key. Who the contemporaries were remains unknown, since despite this author contacting Whiteside, he refused interview requests, while alluding to the fact that he had been stalked after his book was released. Regarding the veracity of Kilgallen's investigation, Whiteside opined, "Unlike most of the crackpots and paranoids who swiftly joined the chorus, Dorothy's suspicions were grounded on apparent fact and backed up by intense research. Her coverage of the case, before and after the Warren Report, was the most aggressive and in-depth being done." Kilgallen not only anticipated many of the theories, since endlessly propounded, she was able to explore and attempt to verify specifics at a time when the trail was still fresh. Dorothy's political and underworld contacts were unrivaled within the Fourth Estate, the press. If any reporter had the capability to follow a chain of conspiratorial evidence to its end, it was Dorothy. Breaking down Whiteside's conclusions, if true, confirms Kilgallen's lofty status for compiling the most compelling JFK assassination investigation in history. When sources for what happened in Dallas are listed regarding their authenticity, Kilgallen's name must be at the very top of the list, since, to reinforce the point, Kilgallen was present from the moment JFK was assassinated in 1963 until her death in 1965, investigating firsthand the events as they transpired, a true eyewitness to history. Regarding the explosive file, authenticating that it did indeed exist is possible through a primary source, Kilgallen friend Jean Bach. She told friends, "We wondered about the folder she had. She brought it to the What's My Line dressing room and said, 'Here's all the stuff I've learned. I'm working on it, and nobody can have a look at it.'" If Hoover or Marcello did not reach into their ranks for an operative and did not employ someone known to either man, then the operative had to either be or become a member of Kilgallen's circle of close friends. He could then report to Hoover or Marcello, or more likely, one of the men's associates or underlings, regarding what evidence she had discovered and where it might lead. Just as Hoover had done, with depositing a mole into Kilgallen's science club, so he could spy on her when they met for their weekly gathering. Such was the plan, so the latest information about Kilgallen's JFK assassination investigation could be garnered. By the time November 1965 rolled around, it is difficult to believe Kilgallen wasn't under surveillance. Both Mark Sinclair and Charles Simpson knew she was, and Kilgallen believed her phones were being tapped, as did her daughter Jill. However effective surveillance and phone tapping might be, nothing was as valuable as having someone on the inside who could directly report her every move. And even more helpful were the details of her pending trip to New Orleans. If Hoover or Marcello or both were planning Kilgallen's demise in November 1965, who would they have used, other than the operatives known to them, to oversee the plan to eliminate her? Hoover was located in the nation's capital, and Marcello operated out of New Orleans, requiring either of these diabolical men to be in need of a New York connection. Regarding either Hoover or Marcello, the logical connection was, surprisingly for both, New York City Mafia Don Frank Costello. Marcello certainly was on friendly terms with Costello, while Hoover had made it a point to establish a friendly truce with Costello. At first exposed in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, Kilgallen was well acquainted with Costello. For whatever reason, those who have written about Kilgallen missed clues apparent in an April 28, 1960 New York Post Daily Magazine article uncovered by this author. It was part of the 10-part series called The Dorothy Kilgallen Story, A Post-Portrait, published April 20th to 29th of that year. Kilgallen being featured in such an in-depth series illustrates the celebrity status and power she enjoyed at the time. There is no indication that any other public figure, let alone a woman, was given such widespread coverage. The article's content put Kilgallen on the power pedestal where she belonged. The series dealt mostly with her Journal American Voice of Broadway column, the radio and television stardom, and her investigative reporting skills. Featured also was background information about her early days and family and her immense popularity. The five writers, headed by David Gelman, called her a true media icon, whose empire stretched into the various folds of American life through the Hearst syndicated columns and articles in Cosmopolitan and Good Housekeeping magazines, among others. The article, while not using the term, was a testimonial to a woman who had truly broken the glass ceiling. The reporters detailed her being the mother of three children while touting the fact that New York City area residents could easily find Kilgallen, since her investigative reporting on famous trials or other fascinating events, including exclusives, a Kilgallen specialty, normally appeared on page one of the Journal American. In addition, her Voice of Broadway column normally appeared on page five. Radio buffs, the article pointed out, could listen to Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick on the radio during the weekdays, and What's My Line was broadcast to millions on CBS every Sunday night. Her friendships with everyone from Truman Capote to Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip to the Duke and Duchess of Windsor to Aldous Huxley and Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton were added to the fairy tale story of a woman who had overcome substantial obstacles to become successful despite being a college dropout. Costello associate and former bootlegger Sherman Billingsley, founder of New York City's Stork Club, called Kilgallen just about the biggest female celebrity around. She was Miss New York. Such plaudits should not be taken for granted. Kilgallen was truly a star, a celebrity in every sense of the word, a major player in so many different aspects of American life, a major player on the major stage. While focusing on Kilgallen's social life, in part 13 of the series, the Post writers noted, "A couple of years ago, Kilgallen and a few of her male friends had what they like to call the Weekly Science Club. It meets every Monday afternoon in a reserved alcove of a well-known Third Avenue bar for the avowed purpose of discussing new ideas and driving away the Monday blues." The article then named a few of the regulars, including Bob Bach, Kilgallen's friend, and a What's My Line associate producer, the same man she had drinks with at P.J. Clark's the last night of her life. The Post writers revealed that each of the regulars could bring a mystery guest to the bar, P.J. Clark's, from time to time. The next sentence read, "Dorothy had brought along Tony Perkins, Psycho, Sugar Ray Robinson, famous boxer, and Frank Costello, among others." Note, this is apparently the same science club previously mentioned in the FBI's 1959 memorandum, detailing how a female bureau informant had infiltrated the club. Johnny Whiteside wrote in Cry that Costello had occasionally joined Kilgallen's table at P.J. Clark's, possibly confirming his being her guest during the Weekly Science Club meetings. Mark Sinclair also spoke of the friendship, stating, "At a little Italian restaurant in Little Italy, we went down there one night, and Costello was there, and he bought us drinks and was very nice to us. She later told me who he was. I did not know who he was. Maybe we were there just to see him. I'm sure Mr. Costello gave her information, but she would never tell me that he did. She knew organized crime figures. She knew a lot of them." He added, "He gave her a diamond cross, and she said, 'I can't wear it since it is so huge.' And so we broke it up and made it into earrings. She wore them a lot." Singer Paul Anka, first introduced to Costello when Anka performed at New York City's Copacabana, said, "Frank was something. Very tough-looking guy, heavy set, bulldogish face, with greased back hair and a big cigar. He was the epitome of that whole mafia thing. Everyone was scared shitless of him. Everyone, perhaps, but not Dorothy Kilgallen." During Kilgallen's era, some glamour was attached to mafia figures, including Costello. In Five Families, author Selwyn Robb wrote, "Judges, important politicians, congressmen, authors, and New York society and cafe figures had no qualms about attending soirees that Frank Costello frequently hosted in his penthouse at the majestic apartments overlooking Central Park. Tastefully decorated in Art Deco style, the only ostentatious notes in the apartment were a gold-plated piano and several slot machines." When interviewed by this author, author Nick Pileggi said gangsters like Costello were called sportsmen or simply gamblers, notwithstanding their underworld connections. Costello's power extended to New Orleans, where Carlos Marcello ruled. After Bugsy Siegel was murdered in Los Angeles, Costello's partner in the City of Angels was Melvin Belli's client, Mickey Cohen. In his FBI file secured by this author through the Freedom of Information Act, Cohen was quoted as saying, "With respect to the notorious Frank Costello, Cohen says he considers Costello to be a fine gentleman." He added, "Frank is a really beautiful and kind human being. Really a good man." Another entry stated, "Costello was in L.A. for secret meetings with underworld figures, including Mickey Cohen. Whenever possible, Costello boasted of bootlegging with Joseph P. Kennedy. Ralph Salerno, a New York detective during that era and an expert on organized crime, said of Costello, "A lot of politicians and judges owed their elections and positions to him." This included NYC Judge Thomas Aurelio, who faced disbarment charges due to his friendship with Costello, his promise to fix cases in return for the mobster's support. Whether Kilgallen and Costello were still fast friends as November 1965 approached is unknown, but friendship would not have gotten in the way of Costello becoming an ally if requested to provide inside information to Marcello about her daily regimen. If Marcello requested the favor, Costello would have squealed on his sister. The Frank Costello-J. Edgar Hoover connection is true cause for assessment. Early on, there were suspicions that Hoover's declaration that no real mafia existed in the United States was due to his having been paid by those in the underworld, or that underworld figures threatened to expose his gay sexual orientation. Apparently, no concrete evidence appeared as to either theory. But there was credible evidence that Hoover met with Costello several times on a Central Park bench to discuss what were dubbed mutual interests, including tips on horses. Sightings of the two men together were also alleged at the Waldorf Hotel and the Stork Club, where owner Sherman Billingsley was the close friend of Costello. According to Hoover's associate George Allen, he witnessed a conversation between them where Costello attempted to speak to Hoover in a public place. Allen quoted Hoover, who had opened an FBI file on Frank Sinatra in 1947, due to his association with hoodlums, as saying, "You stay out of my bailiwick, and I'll stay out of yours." Unsurprisingly, this is exactly what happened, giving credence to a 2018 comment from Robert Kennedy Jr., who, from his father, believed Hoover was a terrible, terrible racist who had strong ties to the mob. He was a compulsive gambling addict and was often accepting markers from some of the biggest mobsters my father was prosecuting. All of this happened, it should be recalled, against a backdrop of Hoover having proclaimed there is no mafia, despite a plethora of evidence to the contrary. Various reasons for this bizarre statement have percolated through the years. Finally, Hoover had to relent when his agents witnessed with their own eyes more than 60 mobsters gather in a historical summit in Appalachian, New York, in November 14, 1957. Among them were Santo Traficante, Joe Bonanno, Carlos Gambino, and Joe Civello, Carlos Marcello's underling in Dallas, along with Joe Campisi, the first person to visit Jack Ruby after he shot Lee Harvey Oswald. Kilgallen did not have the type of friendship with J. Edgar Hoover she enjoyed, at least for a time, with Costello. There are no known photos of Hoover and Kilgallen together, although both frequented the Copacabana nightclub in New York City, where it was known that Costello was a silent partner, meaning he was actually the owner, while using his friend Frank Intratter as the front. Regardless, consider the proven links, among others, between Kilgallen and Ruby, Kilgallen and Belli, Kilgallen and Costello, Ruby and Marcello, Oswald and Marcello, Ruby and Belli, Belli and Cohen, Ruby and Cohen, Cohen and Marcello and Costello, and Hoover and Costello, and by reference to Marcello. That both Marcello and Hoover are part of this chain increases the likelihood they realized something quite in common. Dorothy Kilgallen was the enemy of both. Unfortunately, Kilgallen, Excited as she was about printing the truth about the JFK assassination, based on the realization she had uncovered a true mafia hit operation from start to finish, made the mistake of being too vocal about her intentions. She boasted of her anticipated coup to most anyone, including Sinclair, who said, "I did know from Dorothy, finally, that there was a conspiracy to kill JFK, that it was a group of people, not one," she told me. Sinclair certainly knew of the danger facing her. When investigative reporter Catherine Faubel's associate told him, those at Goodson Todman Productions, producers of What's My Line, refused to discuss Kilgallen's death, Sinclair wasn't surprised, stating, "You could wind up dead." Since Kilgallen had such good instincts and had told so many people, including Sinclair and James Clement, she had been threatened and was scared. The fact that she was killed lends itself to the belief she thought she was invincible. So did Sinclair. Recall his saying that he believed no one could touch her. It makes sense that Kilgallen had the same comfort level. Or did she? Johnny Ray told his manager, Bill Franklin, "Dorothy was very disturbed by the whole thing, the JFK assassination. She was sure there was some kind of a conspiracy. She said she was close to breaking the whole thing open, and also that she felt threatened, life-threatened, as a result of her work." In her syndicated column of December 15, 1976, entitled The Kilgallen Mystery, Kilgallen's rival, Liz Smith, wrote that Kilgallen had told Mark Lane, "I'm going to break this case." When Lane asked her whether she was afraid, she had said, "That's all inconsequential. They killed the President of the United States. The government's not prepared to tell us how it happened or who did it, and I'm going to do everything I can to find out what happened." Never one to show fear, it seems clear that at some point, as the tragic weekend in November approached, Kilgallen was scared. She had told Charles Simpson, "After I have found out now what I know, if the wrong people knew what I know, it would cost me my life." They did. And it did.